I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Freeform, a world that just might work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Chloe Naxman, who at 28 in November, after one term in the House of Representatives of the state of Maine, defeated the incumbent minority leader to move to the state Senate in a rural Republican district. How did she do it? And what does it mean for the rest of us? You can learn more at chloemaxman.com. That's C-H-L-O-E, Maxman, M-A-X-M-I-N. That's all one word, chloemaxman.com. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. Let me just say, as we continue to confront the coronavirus pandemic, and it seems to be getting more intense and all of that, I encourage you, do your part by social distancing, wearing a mask in public, staying home, and by finding ways to help those in your community hurt most by the social isolation and the economic devastation. I often rail against money in politics, gerrymandering, minority rule, and the fragility of democracy in America. I often cite the study by Martin Gillens of Princeton and Benjamin Page of Northwestern. I'm going to quote them. A proposed policy change with low support among economically elite Americans, that's when one out of five are in favor, is adopted only about 18% of the time, while a proposed change with high support, four out of five of the wealthy and the corporations in favor, is adopted about 45% of the time. On the other hand, when a majority of citizens disagrees with economic elites and or with organized interests, they generally lose. Moreover, because of the strong status quo bias built into the U.S. political system, even when fairly large majorities of Americans favor policy change, they generally do not get it. Gillens and Page conclude, Americans enjoy many features central to democratic governance: regular elections, freedom of speech and association, a widespread, if still contested, franchise. But we believe that if policymaking is dominated by powerful business organizations and a small number of affluent Americans, then America's claims to being a democratic society are seriously threatened. In the 2020 presidential election campaign and its aftermath, we've seen what would normally be considered outrageous attacks on the right to vote, the right to have your vote counted, as well as the result of those votes. So where do we look for solutions? Today, I'm going to move away from the focus on national elections and national politics to speak with a state representative who has bucked the obstacles to living democracy by focusing her energies on listening to the citizens she represents and then representing them. Today, this is fairly radical behavior, radical in its simplicity and its potential. As Chloe Maxman and her campaign manager, Canyon Woodward, wrote in an article in The Nation in 2018, we dig into the local, cultivating relationships, utilizing the resourcefulness of our rural communities to build a rooted movement. We see that rural America is alive and beautiful, eager to be heard and remembered. Many have welcomed us into their homes and honored us with stories of family members who are registering to vote just for our campaign, who are voting Democratic for the first time, who have never voted in a midterm, but now are because our movement gives them hope. At 28, according to her bio, Chloe Maxman has been a community organizer for 14 years. In college, she co-founded Divest Harvard, a campaign calling on the university to divest from fossil fuels. After graduating in 2015, she returned home to rural Maine. Maxman was elected to Maine's House of Representatives in 2018 in a district that had voted Republican by a 16-point margin over the past three elections. And this past November, she defeated the incumbent minority leader to become the youngest female Maine state senator in history. Welcome, Chloe Maxman, to Freeform, a world that just might work.
Thank you so much, Terrence. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Monday, December 21st. First of all, how are you? How are you coping with the resurgent pandemic?
All things considered, I feel very lucky. I live in a rural place with pretty manageable COVID right now. I just adopted a puppy, and so I'm pretty okay. I feel blessed.
Okay. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So can you tell us, in your own words, a bit about your path to the work that you're doing today? And feel free to mention childhood inspirations, mentors, turning points, moments of decision.
Yeah, that's such a good question. Canyon and I are in the process of writing a book about our work, and our first chapter is due tomorrow, actually, and we're writing our stories of self. So I've been thinking about this a lot. And I usually tell my story in the same way, but I'm trying to tell it different this go round. I grew up on my family's farm in Nobleboro. My parents were successful urban professionals, and when my brother and I were born, they moved to this tiny town of 1,600 people, quit everything, and started a farm. So that's how I grew up, and I just look back on my childhood with such fondness, taking care of our land and our animals, snowmobiling, fishing, ice fishing, being in the woods and on the lake, and just so deeply loving where I come from. The other big thing that has shaped me is my community. I live in such a kind place. We wave to each other as we drive down the roads and as we walk down the dirt roads. We're there for each other in hard times and good, no matter what. We work hard and we respect each other, and that's what it's always been about. And when I first ran for office, I realized that everyone who raised me is a Republican. We never talked about politics when I grew up. And if it came up, it was always respectful and be like, okay, you think that? Well, I think this, and that's okay. And so that's the culture that I grew up in. And for my whole life, it's instilled in me such a deep love for my home. And there's never any place else that I've wanted to live except Nobleboro, and there's never been anything I've wanted to do except fight for Nobleboro. So that's what I do.
So a community of 1,600, how close is the nearest town of, say, at least 10,000 or 20,000?
Yeah, it's about 15 minutes away. So not too bad, but we have to drive to, go get groceries and do anything. It's a 15-minute drive, but there are certainly parts of rural America that are much more disconnected than that.
Mm-hmm. And Maine, I've read in actually preparing for this interview that Maine is the most rural state in America, which, is surprising given a state like Alaska, for instance. Mm-hmm. And where you are you inland? Are you on the coast? Where are you?
I live about halfway up the coast and inland a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Okay, just to get a picture of that. Any responses to my introduction?
For sure. I think a lot of my motivation to run for local office and dig into local politics has been feeling so disenchanted with the national level and feeling like no matter how much we march or write or email or call or organize, that the national level seems really impenetrable. But that there's so much work to do at the local level that can really protect people from the ravages of climate change and stand up for all of our human rights.
I ran across a speech you made at Bioneers in 2014. So this is 6 years ago when you were a student at Harvard. I myself, I will tell you, have been to Bioneers somewhere between 15 and 20 times. So it's and have interviewed Kenny and others many times over the years. But I wanted to get a sense of, as we're doing sort of your path, what you were saying back then. And you said a few things, and I just want you to sort of respond to them as if they've borne themselves out as your experience has grown, or how they, right? So one was that you felt that we needed all of the above climate strategies, that we needed to approach it in every way. A very personal one was don't use activism as a crutch. Tough for one-dimensional activists to create a multidimensional movement. And then finally, that anger will never sustain this movement, that it's going to take love to sustain the movement to really take care of climate change, or I guess any of the other existential problems we face. Your reflections on what you shared 6 years ago.
Yeah, one thing that I've been learning about myself recently is that I'm very consistent. So I still believe all those things. I think one of the reasons why I think we need an all of the above approach to climate is because we need a movement that involves everybody. And if we don't have strategies that fit different people's needs and desires and visions for themselves, then we're going to have a pretty narrow movement. And we do need to be confronting this climate on this challenge on every single front. So I definitely stand by that one. I definitely continue to find that anger is not a way for me to sustain this work, and that I need to focus on what I'm doing this for, not what I'm fighting against, in order to keep going. I forget some of the other ones that you just said, but
Well,
they
I
still
think that's,
resonated with
yeah,
me.
well, I think it was just that one that was interesting was that I think a mentor had told you not to use activism as a crutch.
I think I remember that one. It's been a long time since I thought about this one, but something that we reflect in our campaign as well, which is that we're more than just our activism. I'm more than just a candidate or a state senator, and in this work, we have to give space for other parts of our identities. And we're full humans, and I think oftentimes it can be easy to just consume yourself with this work because it is genuinely overwhelming. But when you do that, you lose other parts of yourself.
Yeah. And tell me about the moment when you decided to run for the legislature the first time, when you decided to run in the 2018 midterm. You had graduated in 2015. You'd been home back in Maine for a couple of years at that point. Talk about that decision.
There's so many different ways to tell that story. I mean, kind of the more chronological, factual one is I moved back to Maine to really understand why the climate movement was really struggling to get good climate policy passed. I mean, we were able to mobilize hundreds of thousands of people to march on the streets and to get involved with the movement, but we really struggled translating that kind of people energy into political power. And so I moved back to Maine to work on different campaigns and really think about that issue. And I eventually felt so disheartened with what I was seeing from politics and what I was seeing from movement building that I thought, well, why not just mesh all this together and run for office myself? So, but there's some more emotional, personal parts to that story, which is that I was going through some really hard times and just working at bars and restaurants and doing lots of random odd jobs. And I had moved to Portland, Maine, because I thought that I couldn't build my life in Nobleboro unless I had an urban network. And I thought I needed to go to graduate school and get multiple degrees before I could run for office. And I felt like I was just kind of spinning my wheels, waiting for the day when I could move back home. But one February week, I went down to hang out with Canyon in North Carolina, and we talked about politics, and we talked about the need for a new kind of rural politics that prioritized places like the towns that we grew up in. And I was just so inspired by our conversation. I came back home, and a couple of days later, I texted him, "What would you think about moving up to Maine and managing a campaign?" And a week later, I filed to run.
Excellent,
Thank
excellent. And I, by the way, I really appreciate that the sort of things that we think we need to be worthy or ready, which of course, in your case, it turns out pale in comparison to the things you already had, which was a love for your community and an ability to organize. You actually, why I sort of asked that question is that you have made the point in a number of times when I've seen you talk about what you're doing, that the way you run a campaign, the way you campaign for office is really the beginning of how you will serve. And it seems to me what you're saying is the beginning of how we change politics.
Yeah, I really, after campaigning for two cycles, I really so firmly believe that. I think that you know, it's really during the campaign season when it's the only time when you can go on and knock on someone's door and have a real honest conversation about what's going on in the world. If I did that right now or this summer, people would turn me away and think I was crazy. But there's, you know, we're kind of all enmeshed in this culture of politics during a campaign year. And that's something really, that can be really beautiful instead of really depressing as it usually is. And I found that when you campaign differently, you can talk to different types of people, understand different types of perspective, and build a politics that really honors all of that diversity in their community. You know, I think on the left, we have a tendency to kind of just talk with people who agree with us. And in our campaigns, we don't use any of the party resources. So we've been able to really reach out to people who have genuinely never been contacted by a Democratic candidate or canvasser in their entire voting history. So it's a chance to reach beyond and connect and build something that is more reflective of people's current reality.
And did you know as you were beginning to campaign this way, which it seems to me came natural to you, both because of, you know, these were your people and to the your organizing experience, did you see then that it would then define how you would represent?
It slowly dawned on me. The first time that I ran, I had a primary, so I was talking to Democrats for the first few months of my campaigning life, and that, you know, that was pretty easy. But then when I started talking to Republicans and Independents, it so radically changed my view about what organizing is. When I talk to people who feel so frustrated and abandoned by government, who are struggling every day with issues that are inherently political and who just want better for themselves and their families. But we haven't talked to them because they have a different letter left next to their name that doesn't make any sense. And going into spaces like the State House and being elected to represent my community, I hold those stories the closest to my heart because I want to make sure that people do feel heard and they feel like I am there to reflect their voices in Augusta.
Yeah. How were you helped both in making your decision and in running your campaign and in being victorious in both of your campaigns by Maine's Clean Elections Law? And please explain what that is to listeners.
Yeah, in Maine is a very interesting mix. We were very purple, but one of the more progressive things we've done is create a clean election law, which is basically a state fund that allows candidates to run for office without having to fundraise. So you collect a certain number of $5 contributions from voters in your district. And once you collect a certain number, you qualify for state funding. So it's an amazing system because it really makes running for office accessible to anybody. You don't need to be connected to money to run. And also you can spend your time, you know, actually campaigning and talking to people instead of fundraising and making fundraising calls all the time. So we're really lucky to have it. It has been a huge help to our campaign because it has freed me as a candidate to spend all my time talking to my constituents instead of trying to find money for us. There are certain limitations to it. We have very small budgets, you know, so it means that we can't hire proper staff. We could hire some staff part of the time, so it kind of really limits what opportunities you can give folks on the campaign. But the system is worth it. The other amazing part of clean elections is that it bars a candidate from accepting contributions from corporations or PACs. So it really keeps campaigns clean.
Yeah. So are you able, as a candidate, are you able to opt out of this system so that you might be a clean elections candidate versus someone who's calling on corporations for money?
Yes, you can run traditional, you can fundraise your own money, and some candidates do that in Maine. You know, in my community, I know that people are so fed up with money and politics and how that corrupts politicians. I am too. I think we need more programs like the Maine Clean Election Fund all across the country, and it's something that I really want to support. You know, And I think that we shouldn't be pouring so much money into campaigns in the first place. I mean, you know, the fact that we could probably feed every child in this country with the money that was spent on the Susan Collins, Sarah Gideon races, you know, that's disgusting to me. So I think we gotta make sure that campaigns can provide opportunities for employment and education for people who want to be in that field. But there's no need for millions of dollars in my perspective.
Okay, let's talk about this. In the Mainer, I found an article that's the headline basically said, Sarah Gideon lost to Susan Collins the day after she entered the race. And I'm going to read just a little bit about what they said, and then I want you to talk about it, because they end up contrasting your campaign with her campaign. The Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, the DSCC, endorsed Sarah Gideon, and first, it was viewed as a positive. It turned out to be the kiss of death. This is what the Mainer says. Despite spending nearly $60 million, twice as much as Collins, and I bet people didn't know that, Gideon lost by over 8 percentage points, more than 70,000 votes, in a state where Joe Biden beat Donald Trump by over 74,000. So that's nearly 150,000 vote difference. One of the things that happens when you depend on outside PAC money and so on, is that they usually have to focus on negative ads because they cannot explicitly coordinate or recommend voting in a partisan way. And so the option that's left them is negative ads. So suddenly you've got, you know, this $60 million and most of it's being, and an awful lot of it's being spent negatively. And then the Mainer points out, of the 18 Senate candidates endorsed by the DSCC, only four were victorious in November, leaving out the two in Georgia who are in runoff campaigns. So there potentially could be six victorious, but still not a good track record. You, on the other hand, the Mainer points out, ran 100% positive campaign grounded in community values, not party or ideology. Talk just a little bit about that contrast.
Yeah, I mean, the political scene here this year was really intense with the Collins Gideon race plus the presidential. And one of the things that made it really overwhelming was a constant barrage of negative campaigning. Every day, just multiple mailers hitting on one candidate or the other, and it was awful. I mean, nobody wants that in their lives, even in a good year. So we really made an effort to communicate to folks that we were running a positive campaign. We would have done it no matter what the context around us, but we were running a positive campaign that was not focused on pitting one party against another, but we were focused on trying to find common ground around the values of our community. And that really resonated with people. And, you know, I think when, certainly growing up, my association with politics is really negative. You know, I certainly, my first political memory is watching Bill Clinton getting impeached on PBS with my parents. And I've never known it to be anything good or hopeful. But I also know that we need it. And it is around us every day in the deepest, most profound ways. So we have no choice but to do it better, and I think one of the ways that we can start to create even a little bit of space for that conversation is by protecting its right to be positive.
Mm-hmm. And when you got to Augusta, the capital of Maine, you, as I said, in 2018, you won in a district that had won by Republicans by an average of 16 percentage points over the last three elections. You won in that district. And then, of course, the Senate this time, you actually defeated the minority leader in the Senate. What was your reception like in Augusta? And what was your experience like? So it's partly how did they respond to you, and how did you respond to being there?
Yeah, it's Augusta's being a young woman in politics these days has felt very complicated to me. I think people were really surprised that I won both times, but really grateful that I was there. I think, you know, at least in the Democratic caucus in the House, I was a Democrat representing the third most conservative Democratic
district in the state. So mm-hmm. most Democrats did not have the same struggles I had in terms of how to really represent my community. And that was really tricky, but navigated that okay. You know, and I think politics, there is so much space to make politics better, you know, certainly on the campaign trail and also as a representative. I have always felt like it is my responsibility to be available to my constituents. I do coffee with Chloe every month so that people have access to me. I constantly answer my phone and my emails just so that folks can feel like I'm really there and I'm really being accessible. But in so many ways too, politics is politics. And when you have 200 legislators of all backgrounds trying to agree on policy, things get whittled down and compromise happens in ways that maybe it shouldn't always be that way. So it's tough to see that part of it, but to me it just showed the importance of having good people in office, but also having really solid movements on the outside that are gonna hold the conversation line steady and hold politicians accountable. So seeing that from the inside was really empowering too.
Oh, I'm going to ask one question that I thought of earlier and forgot to ask, which is when you mentioned, when I asked you about your path, way at the top of the conversation, you mentioned your story of self. And as soon as I heard that, I thought Marshall Gans, public narratives. Marshall Gans, I will tell listeners, he's been a guest on the show in the past. Marshall Gans has quite a unique career and has made, I think, quite a unique contribution. But just briefly, his career was that he was a student at Harvard, like yourself, class of 1964. He went down to work in Freedom Summer, registering black voters in the South. And rather than come back to school, he stayed working as an organizer, ended up joining with the UFW, the United Farm Workers, became one of the real leaders of the UFW in their successful years of organizing farm workers. He organized he then did more of that over the years and ended up coming back to college in the 90s, graduated finally in 91, went on to his PhD. He now teaches at the Kennedy School, but he does a lot of work outside and was very involved in the Obama campaign of 2008, et cetera, et cetera. And his model is that we tell a story of self, a story of me, a story of we, and a story of now. Talk just a little bit about how that plays out in your political work.
Yes, Marshall Gans is one of my professors at Harvard and has been such a mentor to both me and to Canyon. So much of what we do is inspired by him. Most importantly, he has just taught us the power of storytelling and being personal and vulnerable when you're doing organizing work and taking the time to listen to other people's stories as well. He's a really special human being, and it's important that we bring that kind of humanity to politics.
Very good. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Chloe Maxman, who at 28 in November, after one term in the House of Representatives of the state of Maine, defeated the incumbent minority leader to move to the state Senate in a rural Republican district. How did she do it? What does it mean for the rest of us? You can learn more at chloemaxman.com, and that's ChloeMaxmin, chloemaxman.com. Okay, let's talk about some of your work in the legislature. Tell us about your efforts to pass Maine's Green New Deal, and I would say even how it emerged in your initial campaign for the House, and then how you went about working on it and eventually getting it passed quite overwhelmingly. And I know that for you, it was a combination of inside and outside.
Yeah, when I got elected, I felt very passionately that all of my bills had to come directly from promises that I had made on the campaign trail or conversations that I had with constituents. I did the same thing this year with all the bills I submitted. So when I was campaigning in 2018, I didn't really hear people talk about climate change directly that much. But I heard people say that we wanted to have good jobs in rural Maine, sustainable industries, that we wanted to be able to go ice fishing every winter, and we all notice how the ice comes in so much later than it did when we grew up. So I kind of pulled that all together and was talking with some of the labor unions and wanted to do a green jobs bill. And, you know, for those with some knowledge of the climate movement, we don't have a great history working with labor. And certainly in Maine, sometimes our environmental movement can be a little bit closed and kind of focused on southern urban Maine, you know, kind of white privileged folks, and we leave out a lot of voices. So that's not my community though, and I wanted my climate work to really represent where I come from. So I sat down with the unions and we decided to work on a bill that would be called a Green New Deal for Maine. It was very different from the national Green New Deal. It was a targeted piece of legislation, not a broad, multifaceted resolution. It had no fiscal note, it cost the state no money. And, you know, most importantly, I called it a Green New Deal because I wanted to talk about climate change in a different way, and I wanted people to pay attention to it. I wanted to root the climate conversation in a rural working place and not in an urban privileged place. That was really important to me. The Green New Deal bill started out with 5 different parts. It would have created a Green New Deal task force that really would have charted out a just transition plan for Maine. It was going to set up the Just Transition Commission to make sure that the transition was actually fair and equitable to all Mainers. And all that got taken out because of some political stuff, but 2 pieces remained. One is an apprenticeship piece that requires a certain number of employees on large electricity generation projects to come from apprenticeship programs. And the other one is making sure that schools in Maine have easy access to solar. So that's what ended up coming out of it. So, you know, I think the title often conjures up really big visions of what policy can be, but we were trying to just draw attention to policy that was a little bit different.
Right. In other words, what I hear is your Green New Deal was not the same as the national Green New Deal the AOC and progressive wing of the Democrats have put forward, but you felt the title would help galvanize attention, and then what you would put under that title would be the things that would work for your representatives.
Exactly. And I mean, one of the cool things about the bill is that it was the first, right at the beginning, the national AFL-CIO came out against the national Green New Deal.
Right.
But we were the first state Green New Deal bill in the country to be endorsed by a state AFL-CIO affiliate. And so we really just wanted to say, you know, hey, if we talk about climate change in a different way, if we approach this in a different way with different partners, we can actually do really cool things. We can make our movement bigger and more accepting than it was before.
Now, I also read that 7 green bills ended up passing, including a state renewable energy portfolio standard, a goal of 80% renewable energy by 2030, 100% by 2050. So these were kind of surrounding the initial bill with its 3 provisions?
Yes. Yeah, there were a lot of good climate bills that came in last session since it was the first term with Democratic Governor Janet Mills after 8 years of a very conservative man named Paula Page. So yeah, there's a lot of good climate stuff happening. We still have a long ways to go, but we're certainly getting on the right path.
Okay. Have you been surprised by the national attention that you and your campaigns have drawn? In other words, when it comes down to it, you still represent, you know, for the first 2 years, you represented, you know, a small rural legislative district, and now a, you know, fairly rural Senate district in a state, you know, of a few electoral college votes, if you will, of Maine. And yet I've seen you in Mother Jones, Common Dreams, etc. Have you been surprised, and how do you deal with that?
I guess I haven't really put much thought into it, if I was surprised or not. I think I'm very honored and very humbled. You know, so much of our work is really intentionally trying to do things differently and to pave a better way for the Democratic Party. And so I think to some extent, being able to spread that message and show that tactics are working in a rural conservative place makes me feel hopeful. It makes me feel like maybe some of what we're doing can be used in other places or can really influence how campaigns are run or how the Democratic Party thinks about these issues. So, you know, I like that. I think it's also, you know, I come out of the climate movement. I come out of a progressive organizing background. And what I'm experiencing today is so radically different from what I experienced in those progressive spaces. And I think they're too far apart. So the opportunity to go into some of those spaces like Bioneers or, you know, go back to Harvard and say, hey, I'm discovering this whole world, all these people that we've left behind. We got to change how we're doing things. That's one of the ways that I fight for my community.
Have you found allies among young folks around the country running for office? I earlier this year interviewed Charlotte Alter, also a young Harvard grad, I believe, but she wrote a book, you know, the ones we've been waiting for, in which she profiled a number of young, newly elected folks who'd chosen to run and had succeeded and so on. Have you found, you know, is there a network emerging of young people with new ways of approaching campaigning and politics, or is it too early?
I think it's starting to happen. I mean, there are certainly folks who have been doing this work for a really long time, and you know, I've organized a lot with the divestment movement, and Greta Neubauer in Wisconsin was the first person I knew who ran for office, and that just blew my mind that somebody my age could do that. I was so impressed and inspired, and it's part of what made me think that I could run for office too, is because I saw my peers doing it. So I think it's definitely starting to happen. I have a lot of friends coming to me being like, maybe I'll run for office one day, and we're really just trying to tear down some of those barriers that society puts up for young people who want to run for office. You know, all the things that I felt, you know, that I needed to be married and settle down and have lots of graduate degrees, or, you know, have a specific policy focus, or be the loved one of the Democratic Party. None of those things are actually true. They're just ways to consolidate power.
Exactly. An obstacle is just as potent, even if it's not real, if it's believed.
Yes, it's so true.
And talk a little bit also about how something which fascinates me is this inside-outside, organizing protest, organizing politics, which you have melded. You have brought your organizing. And one of the things that I've read about the way that you engage with voters is that it's reminiscent of deep canvassing. Could you tell people what that is and how that is different? I will tell you, I have been canvassing on and off since 1972. I ran a very conservative assembly district in the state of California for the McGovern campaign when I was 24, back in 1972. Wow. And so this is sort of deep in my experience, but I think this deep canvassing is a new twist. Usually what I've been asked to do as I volunteer for a campaign is, you know, in terms of efficiency, we're just interested in getting out the vote. So if they're not on your side, don't waste time trying to talk them into it. You've engaged someone. If they're on your side, then keep track of them and make sure they vote. But don't try these conversations. Deep canvassing seems to run counter to that. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I've had the exact same experience working on campaigns. Before I ran for office, I worked for Bernie Sanders' campaign, I volunteered on the Hillary campaign, I worked for a local mayoral campaign in Lewiston, Maine, and I was given a script, I was sent out there to ID people, came back to a cold campaign office, given the world's worst cookie, and left to go home and get warm. You know, it was a miserable experience to volunteer for the campaign. And we really didn't want our campaign to feel that way. We wanted it to feel warm and joyful and like we were building community with each other and with the people that we were talking to at the door. So We put a lot of effort into rethinking that model. And one of the ways that we do it is by deep canvassing, which is instead of just showing up and being like, are you voting for this person or not? You ask the person what they're thinking about, what they're experiencing this year, what they want to see in a candidate. And conversations are, you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes instead of 2 seconds. And I think this has been so important for us because we're talking to people who a lot of them have never been canvassed before, and I show up and just simply listen to their stories, listen to what they're experiencing and where they're coming from. I do ask if they'll vote for me, but I don't lead with that. I don't say, hi, I'm Chloe, this is what I believe in. Do you believe in it too?
Uh-huh.
I say, hi, I'm Chloe, I'm running for state senate, wanted to know if there's anything on your mind this year. And because of that, we hear a lot of really incredible, profound stories that shape our campaign. Our work is shaped by the people that we talk to, not by what we think people want to hear. So that's a huge difference. And it's a little bit of a different approach too. So when we send our volunteers to go out canvassing, we end up doing our own volunteer trainings as well. So we really have the chance to tell people, you know, if you're going to talk with someone who voted for Trump, you're gonna knock on doors and drive down driveways that have Trump flags or anti-Black Lives Matter stuff or White Lives Matter or Blue Lives Matter, and you gotta think about how you're going to respond to that and how you're going to have a conversation with that person, because sometimes I've talked to that person and they're going to vote for me. So there's just, it kind of makes the whole campaign world a lot more dynamic, as it should be, because we're dealing with dynamic human beings every day.
Yeah, and without those conversations, everything else that you're aiming to do or trying to create has no foundation.
Exactly.
Yeah, I often say that once food, shelter, health are kind of taken care of, that what human beings want more than anything is to feel seen and heard.
Yeah, I think that is so true. And I think what's happening these days is that local politics now reflects the issues of national politics. Mm. You know, we're not talking about the local dam or like, you know, whatever's happening around here. We're talking about the fact that we can't afford healthcare, that our teachers aren't getting paid enough, that our towns aren't getting enough revenue, that we can't afford to age in our homes, that our children are graduating with student debt. I mean, these are huge issues that politics, government, elected officials at every level have failed to lead on. So yeah, it's just time to do it differently.
And I read that when the COVID-19 pandemic hit, that your campaign stepped up its commitment to engaging directly with voters by enlisting 200 volunteers to check on their well-being. Tell me a little bit about that. So unrelated in a way, I put unrelated in air quotes, but unrelated to whether they were going to vote for you or not, you were just checking on them as potential votes, but as constituents, as community members.
Mm-hmm. When COVID hit, we had already launched our campaign. We had this amazing potluck at the North Melbourne Community Center with 100 folks. I had started canvassing. We were in full swing and had a list of lots of volunteers who wanted to help. But obviously all of that stopped when COVID came along. But we still had all of these volunteers and access to the voter database with everybody's phone number. And we really wanted to use that capacity and our infrastructure for good. So we started to call seniors in our community. I live in the oldest county in the country. Mm. And we just checked in on people to see if they were okay. And we found that there was a lot of need. There were a lot of folks out there in the woods who had no support. So we started to put out the word. We had 200 volunteers join our COVID relief network. We made over 13,500 phone calls to seniors in our community. We ended up calling every senior who lived here. And we helped people connect with food you know, I live in a rural place, all the transportation services had shut down, and so we ended up kind of creating this ad hoc transportation network, bringing people to and from the hospital, to doctor's appointments, to cancer treatments, and that network has continued to this day. People still need rides, and those services aren't here, so we provide them. We had an old woman who could only read large print books because she was going blind, but all the libraries were closed, so our network found some large print books for her. You know, prescription pickups, kind of just the basics that people need in their lives that they couldn't do when they were stranded or afraid to go out. We just stepped in, and you know, this campaign was not about getting me elected. It was about being there for our community, and that was the best use. That was the best thing we could have done.
Yeah. And what you're saying is that continues on now after that volunteer work continues after the election because the need's still there.
Yeah, it absolutely does. Transportation is such a huge challenge where I come from, and it's something that I work on in the legislature, but you know, volunteer networks are a big part of how we support each other, and we've really stepped into that space a lot in our community. And you know, campaigns just amass these amazing volunteer lists, and we just, you know, we wanted to give all of those resources to the local advocacy organizations and make sure they could do what they needed to do.
Let me ask you about a notion that I have been thinking about and writing about for a little while, and it's I call it 60s 2.0. And what I mean by that is that the more time that I spend with young people, millennials and younger, I get the feeling that many of the questions and visions and values that sort of I thought were the best of the 60s are alive again today. And that there's reasons that I think we have a better chance of a deeper, more sustainable transformation of society this time around. One is that technology makes it easier either to reduce material consumption in favor of the environment and so on, but also to connect, to organize and so on. And second, that there's such a larger talent pool. In the 60s, almost all the leadership was male. If it was a white organization, white male, African-American organization, black male, etc. And now it seems men, women, trans, all the whole, you know, spectrum of gender and ethnicity and all of that seems to be available, and more talent, more creativity. And finally, that we were sort of on our own in the 60s. There were, you know, a few beatniks in San Francisco and a few in Greenwich Village, but whereas now there are, you know, what I'm sort of hoping for is an intergenerational kind of a movement that shares values and then has different roles and different methods and so on, but that we can, you know, really have a transfer, as I say, a sustained transformational effect. Your thoughts about that?
I think I resonate with so much of that. I think there's so much power and potential in everybody these days, and especially in the younger generation. I think there's just a lot of stereotypes about young people and young people in positions of power, young people as candidates or as organizers, and some of the smartest, most insightful people that I work with are younger folks, and it's so inspiring, and it's so important to make sure that spaces like state legislatures are really reflecting the identity of our communities, and part of that is having more young people in office. So, I think it could definitely be 60s 2.0.
Now, the other side of that is, you know, the okay boomer, like you had your time, you failed, let us run things. What do you see about, you know, the value of both together?
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, one of the groups that I work with here in Maine, it has just an amazing model of kind of getting rid of the idea of a mentor and saying, because mentor kind of implies age and experience, But it really acknowledges that young people have a lot to teach and young people have a lot to learn, and older folks have a lot to teach and they have a lot to learn. And so I really kind of look at it that way, which is kind of less age-based and more from the perspective that we all have places where we need to grow and expand the way that we think. I mean, certainly, my parents are my inspiration, my role models, and they're older folks. Some of the people that I look to in the legislature are not my age, and I certainly learn a lot from people who are older than I am. But I also look at people who have been campaigning the same way every cycle, or doing the same work over and over again, and it is clearly ineffective, and I don't want to do it that way. And I get pushback when I try and do it differently, but I think that's just human nature, and I'm overly empathetic by fault, and so I think everyone, or not everyone, but most people are just doing their best and have good intentions, and I just try and do my own thing around those dynamics.
We talked about story a couple of times in here. Let me read you a quote that I read soon after the 2016 election, which really got to me. It was by Antoine Saint-Exupéry, the man who wrote The Little Prince.
Mm.
If you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea.
Mm.
And to me, that struck my heart, that's what we need to do. We need a new story that people who think they're opposed to each other really know that in this new story, they're not. In this new story, they're together, and there's something out there. There's something worth dreaming about and overcoming differences to achieve and so on. What are your thoughts about what have you found is the story that works, and what do you think is this new narrative? I mean, obviously, one of the things that generated that reflection for me is that it looked to me that a lot of Trump supporters, and as we know, he got more votes this time than last time, even after the pandemic, is a yearning for the past rather than the future.
Interesting. I think we're living in such deeply complicated times, and at the beginning I mentioned how much I love my community and our kindness and respect, but this year when I was canvassing, it was the first time in my life when I felt like that was slipping away. I felt like the divisions and the polarity and the hatred of everything around us was really changing this beautiful, special place that raised me. And so much of our campaign was trying to hold on to that and be like, saying what you're saying is that we can have a different story. We don't have to succumb to the forces that are trying to tear us apart. We can choose to do this in a way that brings us together. And I think that a lot of people voted for Trump because, at least from what I hear from people, because they just want something different. And I don't know if that's looking in the past, but just hoping for something better in the future. When, I hear folks who have worked their whole lives and still can't afford to retire, and it's unjust and it's unfair and it's politics' fault, and we need something different. And, Trump, for better or for worse, is different. So, I don't think people want the future to look like the past. I think they want the future to look better. And, we just differ on what gets us there. And I really, really hope that we can remind ourselves of who we are and not lose sense of our humanity and the beautiful shared values that make communities and rural communities so special. I feel like we're at a loss of letting that slip away if we don't try really hard to hold on to it.
So that story to inspire people to stay involved, to stay plugged in, or to get involved have you found in your talking with people or in your thinking about it that there's a story of the future that you see?
That's a really good question. I think especially with COVID, and thinking back on all the conversations that I've had with people, my story of the future is one that makes sure that we are really resilient and that all Mainers are treated equitably and fairly. All Americans are treated equitably and fairly. There have been such profound injustices in our society for way too long, and they're all at the surface right now, and it's just awful to see. So, you know, I don't want to say I want to go back to a time when everyone was treated the same, because I don't think we were ever there.
Right.
But I, you know, I have hope that we can get there one day, you know, in ways that really protect those who are most vulnerable, that really lift up the voices that need to be heard. And that makes us stronger, because we know that other crises are coming our way. We know that the climate crisis is going to shake up our world in ways that we cannot even imagine. And COVID showed that we are not ready, and that a lot of people who can't afford to be hurt are hurt. So my vision is for all that to change.
Yeah, and as I remember what you've said, is that you begin with values, not party or not policy. And it seems to me that as I asked you about your story of the future, it's basically about values.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, I guess so.
Okay, we're going to bring this to a close. Again, Chloe Maxman is 28, and she is a state senator in the state of Maine, and the website to learn more is chloemaxman.com. That's Chloe, Chloe, Maxman, Maxmin, all one word, chloemaxman.com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, usually 8 or 10 articles of relevance and timeliness, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and at most other major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts there. In a searchable form, Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, etc. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. And thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all, you, my listeners, please share this conversation widely. And finally, thank you, Chloe Maxman, and keep up your good work.
Thank you so much, Terrence. I really appreciate it.